Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
At 10 a.m. on the morning of February 2nd, 2008, the Lane Bryant store in Tinley Park, Illinois, opened for the day. Just minutes later, a man entered the store posing as a delivery person. He eventually pulled out a gun and took the store manager, a part-time employee, and four customers hostage. The six women were forced into a back room where they were bound with duct tape and shot execution style. The store manager and the four customers were killed instantly, but the part-time employee survived. She had moved just as the gunman fired, and although she was shot in the neck, she lived to give police a detailed description of the killer. Despite her account and an extensive investigation, the gunman has never been identified. It's been over 16 years since Rhoda McFarland, Jennifer Bishop, Carrie Chuso Hudek, Connie Woolfolk, and Sarah Safransky were murdered, and investigators are still searching for the person responsible. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals and organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. Okay, so the Lane Bryant shooting, another mysterious case. This is one that's going to frustrate a lot of people. It definitely frustrates me. And I really think it's important for shows like Detective Perspective to cover these cases because as we get into the end of this episode and we talk about where we go from here, I really think it's going to take either an advancement in technology or someone coming forward with information. And I will tell you that more than likely, that person has had this information all along. We have fingerprints. We have DNA. We have sketches. We have 3D enhancements. And if the enhancement is accurate, and I'm assuming it is, I don't understand how this guy hasn't been caught yet. I really don't. But yet here we are 18 plus years and this person is still out there, or maybe they're not. But we're going to save that for the end. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about the different things that happened in this case, how we got to this point, and how we ended up with 5 murders, 6 victims, and a person who really didn't do a great job of covering up their identity, and yet investigators are puzzled. We still don't know who this person is. And there's 6 families out there still seeking justice. So we're going to do our part tonight. We're going to cover this episode. So let's not waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. In early 2008, 42-year-old Rhoda McFarland, a U.S. Air Force veteran, was working as the store manager for Lane Bryant, a women's clothing retailer, located in Tinley Park, Illinois. Although Tinley Park is a suburb of Chicago, it was considered a generally safe area. There had only been 2 murders in the last 9 years, and 15 robberies the year before this incident. And to give some additional context, the Lane Bryant store was located in an outdoor shopping center just south of Interstate 80. The center features several well-known stores, including Super Target, Kohl's, and a number of restaurants. On the morning of Saturday, February 2nd, 2008, Rhoda arrived at the store and opened it at 10 a.m. There was a clearance sale that day, so the store was expected to be busy. Working alongside Rhoda was a part-time employee. Her name has never been publicly released for her own protection. She would end up being the sole survivor of what unfolded that morning, and everything we know about the shooting comes directly from her. Now, according to NBC, within just 8 minutes of the store opening, a tall, husky-built man who appeared to be a delivery person walked in holding paperwork and claiming he had a delivery. Rhoda was at the cash register with less than $200 inside while the part-time employee was near the entrance. When the part-time employee greeted the man, he seemed completely normal, even asking if he was in the right store. The man then briefly glanced at the ceiling as if he was searching for security cameras, and after realizing that there weren't any, his demeanor completely shifted. At that moment, he pulled out a .40 caliber Glock handgun, pointed it at the woman, and announced that this was a robbery. He then forced them both to the registers and ordered them to hand over all the cash. As the robbery progressed, he became angry whenever the women didn't respond exactly as he wanted. He swore, shouted, and grew increasingly aggressive. At some point, two female customers entered the store. All four women were then forced into a small employee break room at the back of the business. According to NBC, the gunman then ordered them to empty each other's purses and then bind one another's wrists and feet with duct tape that he had brought with him. The women didn't resist and complied with his demands, begging him to just take the money and leave. But instead, he covered their heads with underwear from the store and forced them to lie face down on the floor. At one point, he groped the part-time employee before leaving the room to confront two other female customers who had just entered the store. Those two women were then forced into the break room as well. Now at this point, the gunman had six women tied up in the back room: store manager Rhoda McFarland, the part-time employee, and four customers. Their names were Jennifer Bishop, Carrie Chuso Hudek, Connie Wolfolk, and Sarah Safransky. So you have a scary situation here because you have an individual who's emotional, erratic, and in possession of a gun. And they appear to be motivated by money, and yet they're bringing all these women to the back room. And as I mentioned, he groped one of them. So I'm sure at this point, the women are all wondering what's going to happen here. And we're going to get into all that. We're going to take our first break. We'll be right back.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Okay, we're back, and I want to talk about each of the customers that I mentioned before the break, but I want to give you a little bit more detail about them. 34-year-old Jennifer was a nurse and mother of three who had come to the area for a conference. Carrie, a 33-year-old high school social worker, was shopping for clothes to wear to a get-together with college friends. Connie, a 37-year-old mortgage lender and single mother of two boys, was looking for an outfit for a rare night out with friends. And 22-year-old Sarah had possibly stopped by to pick something up for her job in the accounting department at CNA Financial in Chicago. All of these women were now in the break room together, terrified and helpless, doing everything they could to survive this robbery. Their only hope was that the gunman would take the money and leave, but as time passed, it became clear that he had no intention on doing so. However, at one point, there was a sliver of hope when the gunman left the room again and Rhoda managed to free her hands. Instead of escaping through a nearby exit, she grabbed her cell phone and dialed 911 at 10:44 a.m. Now, let's not skate over what I just said here. Think about it. Rhoda had the opportunity to escape. She would have got away. And yet, she stayed behind for a part-time employee that she probably knew a little bit and four customers who she had never met. She stayed behind to risk her own life, to call 911, to try to save all of them instead of just herself. And when you think about that and you think about the fact that she was a veteran, it's not much of a surprise. But I will tell you, in these moments, these fight or flight moments, you really find out a lot about someone. And I found out everything I need to know about Rhoda. What a courageous woman that she was. And it's incredible to see human beings act like this in moments of extremely high stress. And it's really surprising to see what we are all capable of in those moments. We are a very divided society, and yet it's amazing how we will come together and what we will do for others when given an opportunity to flee or run towards the battle. And Rhoda stayed in it right until the end, and I have nothing but respect for her in this moment, because I don't want to go too far ahead, but even though we're here talking about this and it's obviously not under good circumstances, her making that 911 call was critical and may eventually be the reason why we solved this case. So Rhoda calls 911, but unfortunately the gunman re-enters the room shortly after, shouting, "I see you." The call ends, and then gunfire erupts shortly after that. Now, I do have the 911 call, and I'm going to play it for you now. I think it's important, but it is a bit difficult to make out everything. But what I want you to focus on is the man's voice and see if you recognize it, because that's what's critical here. And before I play it, it's important to note that investigators do have additional audio from this call that has not been released to the public. But nevertheless, there is a lot here, and you can clearly make out this man's voice. So take a listen and see what you think.
911 emergency.
Hey, Brian.
You know.
So you can hear it there. It's really hard to make out the words. I've tried doing it with different headphones. I've tried even using these stage headphones, which are very expensive and used for concerts by musicians. And I still can't make out most of what he's saying, but you can hear his voice. And coupled with everything else we're going to talk about tonight, you would think that that would be enough for someone to recognize him. And yet here we are. But still, doesn't matter what I'm able to recognize or what I'm able to hear. All it takes is one person out there. Now, according to the Chicago Tribune, a police officer had been responding to a call at the Target only 300 yards away when he heard the 911 call come in, and he arrived at the Lane Bryant store at 10:46 a.m., so only 2 minutes later. Now, unfortunately, when he entered, the gunman was already gone, but what he did find was a massacre. Rhoda, Jennifer, Carrie, Connie, and Sarah had all been shot in the back of the head. The part-time employee was the only survivor. She had shifted her head just before the gunman pulled the trigger, and the bullet struck her in the neck, narrowly missing any vital areas. She played dead until the police arrived. The surviving victim was rushed to the hospital, where she later provided a statement to the police, and we'll go more into detail about that in just a minute. CNN reported that the shopping center was placed on lockdown as officers conducted a thorough search of the area. It was eventually reopened once authorities confirmed that the gunman had already fled. Multiple agencies, including the FBI, were brought in to investigate the mass murder, and they initially theorized that this was a botched robbery. However, they were careful not to get tunnel vision. Now, I want to talk about this botched robbery theory and whether I agree with it or not. I think this is the perfect part to do it, and I do apologize if you're watching on YouTube and I'm looking down at my notes, but I can't memorize it all. So let's talk about this robbery and talk about what we have so far in this episode. First off, it occurred in the early morning hours. Why is that important when deciding whether this was someone who was a professional or a novice? Well, with these stores, as I mentioned at the top of the show, they will start with a certain amount of cash. In this case, it was $200. But as the day progresses and the store makes sales, the cash register will be filled with more money. So professionals out there know that unless the stores are doing drop-offs throughout the day, and most of them are not, it's better to rob the store at night than in the morning when there's going to be less cash inside. So they will wait to the end of the day, let all the transactions happen, and then they'll rob the store. So the fact that this person went in there in the early morning hours tells me that this was not someone who was experienced, and this was probably their first time. The second indicator that this was done by someone who wasn't a professional is the fact that it occurred at a shopping center. There's a lot of stores you can rob. If you're looking for a place where you can get in, get out, and not necessarily be seen by a lot of people and maybe avoid apprehension, you have a situation here where this individual chose a shopping center, absolutely packed with people, with different stores, and most importantly, a lot of cameras. So out of all the places you could pick, a shopping center would probably be at near the bottom of the list, and yet that's what they chose. Another point is that it occurred on a Saturday. Yes, there's going to be more business, so more cash, but we've already contradicted that point by them going in the morning. So you're left with a negative, which is it's a Saturday, everyone's out of work, so there's going to be more people there, so more opportunity while you're in the store for customers to come in. These are all things that do not align for a successful robbery if that's what you're trying to pull off. And then you have the duration. Usually with robberies, they're quick hits. They go into the store, they know what they're there for, they get it, and they get out. In this case, you have the offender being there for approximately 40 to 45 minutes, which is not a good idea. It creates opportunity for more customers to come in, and it increases the likelihood that they're going to get caught. And yet this person stuck around, and they were just kind of going with the flow. Whatever was happening, they were reacting to it. And that does not appear to be someone who went in there with a plan. And by the way, I haven't forgotten about the elephant in the room. This person wore no face covering, no mask. So you could look at that two ways. Either they went in there with the intention on not leaving any witnesses, which is possible, or they're just a really shitty robber. And I'm going to go with the latter. So what do we take from all of this? Well, I'm looking at a couple things. First off, this is someone who, as I said, not a professional, inexperienced, and more than likely desperate. Why would they be desperate? Well, it's early morning. They're looking for cash. They're trying to get as much as they can. This is unprepared. It's kind of spontaneous. Could be connected to drugs. This could be a situation where they're walking by the area. They need money fast. They see Lane Bryant. There's only a couple people inside. So that's what they go for. And if that doesn't resonate with you at this point, let me add one more wrinkle to the equation. Remember what I said at the top of the show. When the gunman entered the store, they immediately looked up at the ceiling to see if there was security cameras, which indicates that there was no type of recognizance before this actual incident, which indicates that it was in the spur of the moment. Again, further demonstrating that this was someone who was not a professional and was desperate for money. But that's just some of my observations, and I'm sure the investigators in this case had a lot of observations and opinions on not only the offender, but also the motive. And that's when you have to direct your attention towards the actual evidence. Forensically, what do you have? What is it telling you? And that's extremely important in any case. So investigators did conduct an extensive search of the Lane Bryant store looking for any evidence that might provide more clues. They collected a significant amount of physical evidence, including fingerprints and shell casings, which were immediately sent for testing. Now, like I talked about earlier, there were no cameras inside the Lane Bryant store. However, authorities gathered surveillance footage from other businesses within a 1.5 mile radius. It took days to sift through all the footage, but eventually, investigators found video from the Target showing a dark-colored SUV and a smaller sedan parked in front of the Lane Bryant around the time of the shootings. Although the footage was grainy, they could see that one car pulled in at 10:39 a.m. and the other arrived 1 minute later. And then both vehicles left at 10:46 a.m., just moments before the officer arrived at the scene. And if you're watching on YouTube, the video was playing while I was talking, and you can see that it's very difficult to make out a make or model of the vehicle. You can barely even see the cars. Yes, you can identify them. Yes, you can see that one's an SUV, one's a sedan, but that's really it. You're not going to be able to make out a license plate. And as we talk about these vehicles, yes, it's important to identify them. Does it mean that they were both involved? Absolutely not. This was a shopping center. Not all vehicles park in the area of the store they're going into. They may start at one end and walk to the other and then come back to their car. But it is interesting the duration in which the cars were there and then they were gone. As I said, one car pulled in at 10:39, one pulled in at 10:40, and then 6 minutes later, they both leave. So that's important. So do I think that at least one of those two vehicles are involved? Probably. That would explain how the offender was able to get out of there so quickly. As far as the second vehicle, it's interesting because I just gave you all these points about how this wasn't a premeditated robbery and it appeared to be just kind of a spur of the moment type thing. But if you have two vehicles involved and one of the drivers is the lookout vehicle, I guess, then that would suggest some type of premeditation. How do we explain that? Well, you could have a situation where if I'm right and this is somehow drug related, maybe these two individuals had met up prior, desperate for cash, but were both in their separate vehicles and decided to drive over together and see what they were going to do. And then in that moment, everything went down. I don't think we'll ever really know unless we find the person responsible. But nevertheless, regardless of the involvement of these two vehicles, whether they were involved or not, it is important to identify them if for no other reason than to rule them out. And at this point, We haven't had anyone come forward to say, hey, that's my truck, or hey, that's my sedan, which you could have a situation where it's just because the owners of that vehicle are unaware that they are in question or they're being looked at, or it's because they were actually involved and they're hoping that nobody ever identifies their vehicles. But yes, we have to figure out who those cars belong to, because if we're right and one of them was involved in the robbery, then that truck will more than likely, or that car will more than likely, lead back to the suspect. Now, back to the actual quality of the footage. As I said, it's grainy, so I don't know if we're ever going to be able to find these cars. And I will say that a NASA scientist came in later and actually enhanced the footage, but even with all that effort, they were not able to identify a license plate number. So that's where we are really on this. The quality is not great, but it's all we have. So even if you're listening on audio and you have the opportunity, come over and watch it on YouTube so you can watch the footage for yourself. Now, while the police continued their investigation, the surviving victim recovered in the hospital. And once she was well enough, she took part in several interviews with investigators, providing an incredibly detailed description of the suspect. She described him as being a husky, medium to dark complected black man with broad shoulders, estimated to be between 25 and 35 years old, standing around 6 foot to 6 foot 2 inches tall and weighing between 230 and 260 pounds. He was wearing black jeans with writing or embroidery featuring rhinestones on the back pocket and a black jacket that was below waist length with no visible writing. She noted he was well-groomed and he was wearing a charcoal gray knit cap. Now, even though he was wearing a knit cap, she could see that his hairline was receding, with thick braided hair pulled straight back. His hairstyle included 3 to 5, quote, puffy cornrows, one of which hung over his right cheek and had green beads. Now, this is crazy that we have this description with these green beads. Someone more than likely did this for him. We've all seen cornrows a million times. That's not out of the ordinary, but at least in my experience, I haven't seen as many people with the one cornrow down the side, specifically with green beads, right? Green beads. How many people from that area had that hairstyle with green beads? Probably not too many. And yet this made national news, but nobody in that community recognized that description at all. Nobody was familiar with someone who had that hair design or maybe did it for this person. I just find that very hard to believe. Now, once authorities had this detailed description, they began working on a sketch of the suspect, though it wouldn't be ready for days. After the victim was released from the hospital, she was placed in protective custody, and she later issued a written statement through police, which read in part, quote, "On Saturday, February 2nd, an unspeakable tragedy occurred, and 5 of the bravest women I have ever met were senselessly murdered and taken from their families. My deepest sympathies and condolences go out to their families and their friends. Please know that during the unfathomable events on that day, their thoughts were focused on you and coming home. My heart aches that they were unable to do so, and I am working with the authorities in any way possible for all of the victims. I ask that any person who can assist in this investigation contact authorities immediately." Within a week of the shooting, around 50 investigators were still working tirelessly on the case. They were sorting through more than 170 tips, analyzing evidence, and continuing to collaborate with the surviving victim to develop a sketch of the suspect. The search for evidence was also ongoing. Investigators scoured frozen ponds and streams, conducted grid searches along roadsides and interstates, and handed out flyers at Brookside Marketplace to raise awareness. Investigators were also exploring multiple angles, the robbery gone wrong theory, as well as the possibility that the killer might have had a personal connection to one of the victims. However, ABC7 reported that no evidence to support the personal connection theory was ever found, and I have to tell you, I don't believe that either. If this killer knew one of these victims and wasn't wearing a mask, it's highly likely that during this whole encounter, one of them, if they knew him, would have said, "So-and-so, stop this. Why are you doing this?" Something along the lines. And our surviving witness would have heard that and relayed it to authorities. So I don't need the media to say there's no evidence of a personal connection. If one of these women knew who this guy was, they probably would have referred to him by name, or they would have tried to stop him or deter him from doing what he was doing. And yet, from what we know, that doesn't appear to be the case. So I don't think there's a lot of weight to that theory. So we're right in the thick of this case, but we still have a lot more to cover, specifically the sketch. We haven't even discussed that yet. And I will tell you that once you see the final version of it, I think it's going to surprise you as much as it surprises me that we're sitting here in 2024 and this guy hasn't been caught. But we're going to take our last break. We'll be right back.
What's up, fools? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
All right, we're back. And as I mentioned, we have to talk about this sketch. So let's get right into it. On February 16th, police released a composite sketch of the suspect based on the surviving victim's description. When asked why it had taken so long, they explained that they wanted to ensure the sketch was as accurate as possible. And I have no issues with that whatsoever. You want to get it right. A few days later, portions of Rhoda's 911 call were also made public, and the police urged everyone to listen closely to the call and see if they could recognize the suspect's voice. Tips poured in following the release of the sketch and the 911 call, but despite an influx of information, the killer wasn't identified. The investigation continued with DNA and fingerprint evidence collected at the scene being submitted to CODIS and APHIS, but no match has ever been found as far as we know. So what is CODIS and APHIS for anybody who doesn't know? Well, CODIS, and I have it written down here because I forget the acronym sometimes. CODIS is Combined DNA Index System, which is a DNA database, a national database that uses DNA and software to connect different jurisdictions so that if a DNA profile is uploaded, it could connect to anybody throughout the country. And the way the DNA gets uploaded into that system is whether it's found at a crime scene or if the person is arrested for a felony and their DNA is taken during the processing after that crime was committed and they were apprehended. But what's interesting about CODIS, and I think gives us a little insight into the DNA collected at this particular crime scene, is there's a few parameters that have to be met in order for law enforcement to upload that DNA to CODIS. You can't just have some partial profile and say, you know what, I'm going to throw it in there for the hell of it. It's pretty strict. So one of the requirements is it has to have a minimum number of DNA markers. The second piece of criteria is it cannot be a mixture. So it can't be a combination of the offender and the victim. And the final piece of criteria, which might be the most important, it has to be reasonable to assume that the DNA being uploaded does belong to the offender. So that would mean they've canceled out anybody else as far as who the DNA could belong to, and that's what they have. Now, in a store like this, that DNA could be anybody's, but again, reasonable to assume it belongs to this offender, so it must have been found in a location that they know had been touched by the offender in that time in which this whole incident occurred. So I think that's extremely important, and it means that this DNA is probably pretty viable, which we don't always have. As far as APHIS, that's the fingerprint identification system, and what the acronym means, it's Automated Fingerprint Identification System. With APHIS, you can upload full prints or you can upload partial prints. So with that, it's not as promising because they may not have a full print. It could be a partial print and it may not be as good as the DNA evidence that they have. And all of this brings us to the most important question, which I'm sure everyone is asking. If you have all of this, why hasn't he been found yet? Well, it could be a few things. On the fingerprint side, if it's a partial print, you need a certain number of identifiers to make that match. So if you don't have that, the software may not find the person it's connected to. And just as a side note for anybody who might be asking, from what we understand, the gunman was not wearing gloves, according to the witness. So that wouldn't explain why there hasn't been a connection in APHIS. If there's not a connection, like I said, it's got to be a smudge print or a partial print, and there's just not enough markers. And on the DNA side, As I mentioned, unless they had committed a crime like this in the past and their DNA was found at that scene, or they were arrested for a serious crime, CODIS wouldn't have their DNA. And that's assuming that they have been arrested, right? I'm under the assumption that more than likely this person has a previous criminal history, but it's also possible that they don't. And even if they do, if it's for a minor offense, yes, you may have the fingerprints, but again, if we only have a partial print in the system, you may not have a match. And if it's only a minor crime, they wouldn't have their DNA in CODIS. So that could be what we're looking at here. And it's unfortunate, but sometimes criminals don't have to be good. They just have to be lucky. So that's where I'm at as far as the forensic evidence. But back to the sketch, because we've all seen it now. It was good, but it wasn't great. So in June, authorities released a 3D composite of the suspect. While the physical description remained the same, this new rendering offered a more lifelike depiction of the killer. And once again, when this 3D composite was released, tips came in, but none of them led to anything concrete. And as time progressed, the case began to fade from the media spotlight, though police continued to work with other agencies, reviewing all the evidence and searching for anything they might have overlooked. But despite all of these efforts, no arrest has ever been made. In 2013, 5 years had passed since the shooting. Police revealed to ABC 7 that they had chased leads as far as London, but still had no solid breakthroughs. They also said they hadn't been able to determine why the gunman had entered the store in the first place. I have a couple guesses on this. I'm sure they do as well. And yeah, I think we all want to know the why, but I'm really interested in the who. And in many instances, if you're able to identify the offender, you'll find out the motive. So that's first and foremost. Let's find the guy who did this. It's also worth noting that when they came out with this statement, one detective commented stating, quote, "If I were to make a best guess, it was probably a robbery that failed. However, every time we focus on one thing, there's something there that just doesn't fit right." And I can completely relate to this. I've been in this situation many times, and it's disheartening as an investigator. You're following a series of leads, you have a suspect, and you start to check off the boxes needed to identify or solidify the person that you have in question. And then one thing will throw it off and it'll be exculpatory in nature, which means there's no way this person was involved. However, I don't think that's probably the situation here. What I think is probably going on here is there are actions or evidence that suggest this was a spur of the moment, desperation type thing. And there are other pieces of evidence that suggest it was premeditated. And if I had to go out on a limb, I would say the two vehicles may be some of that evidence that's kind of throwing them off. And I hear where they're coming from, and I love the fact that they're keeping an open mind. So I understand where they're coming from, but the reality is sometimes it's hard to rationalize the irrational. What I mean by that is if this person was desperate, in the process of doing whatever they did, they may have displayed some behavior that appeared to be premeditated, even though it wasn't. And conversely, the other side can happen. It can be premeditated, but because it's so terribly done, it looks like it's just put together at the last minute. So I hope that they're keeping an open mind and in many instances, not always, Occam's razor, right? The simple explanation is the right one. May not be the case here, but from where I'm sitting, that potentially is what we're looking at. Now, by 2018, a full decade had passed since the shooting, and police released a new 3D image of the suspect created by the Michigan State Police based on the original eyewitness sketch. They used new facial identification technology, which provided an even more lifelike visual of the suspect. You guys have to check this out. If you're listening on audio, Google it, come to this video, whatever you got to do. It's incredible. I haven't seen this before. And if I have, I didn't realize that it was done like this. I don't know if this is the guy and how accurate it is to the actual suspect because we're going off the original witness. And although I want to believe they're on the money for sure, as I've said before, sometimes witnesses can be off. But if they have affirmed that this is what the guy looks like, it's unbelievable. I mean, it really looks like a person that would be easily identifiable to people who know him. And yet, again, here we are, covering the case on Detective Perspective because clearly it's unsolved. It's a head scratcher for sure. And the lead detective on this case, who had been involved since day one, also spoke to NBC 5 Chicago, sharing that three times over the last 10 years, they had brought in a viable suspect only to find that the lead fell apart. He stated, quote, "It's very hard to look at the victim's family and not give them the answer. I want to be able to tell them who committed the crime. The detective also mentioned that they had received more than 5,000 tips over the years, and he believed the answer to the case was somewhere in one of them. And that's encouraging, but also disheartening at the same time. I'm sure you're all asking, how do you comb through over 5,000 tips? And there were multiple agencies working on this, but remember, they have other cases, not only in their own department, but in the other agencies. And not all these tips are going to be good. Not all the sources that they come from are going to be viable. And yet you have this daunting task of checking them one by one. And the people doing this are human beings. So it's easy to have something slip through the cracks, or if you have multiple people doing it and it's not being documented in a way where information is being shared with the other people checking their leads, basically like a deconfliction or something that would flag if multiple people get the same name, that's where you can run into an issue. And that's when you can have a similar circumstance like we've had in other cases where years later, a new fresh set of eyes says, hey, you had these tips come in 5 years ago and this name came up and then it came up again and then it came up again. Why didn't this person get looked into? And what we usually find is that the way the information was organized or filed by the different investigators working the case, it wasn't put into a system where those names would ping someone to let them know, hey, you have a flag here. This person's been brought up multiple times. So organization and structure of the filing of these reports is critical to solving these cases, especially when you have 5,000 to 10,000 tips coming in. That's absolutely incredible. Now, by February of 2024, 16 years had passed since the massacre at Lane Bryant. The Tinley Park police chief told CBS that one detective still works full-time on the case, and they continue to receive tips all the time. The investigation remains active, and they take every lead seriously. He also noted, quote, as technology changes over time, there are new things that are available to us. So new ways of processing the evidence, new ways of looking at the information and the materials we've gathered, that changes over time, and as technology changes, that gives us a window to look at things differently. And I can't agree with this any more than the way he said it. We are in a world right now where science and technology, especially when it comes to forensic evidence, is evolving rapidly. And what couldn't be done a year ago can now be done when it comes to hair follicles, DNA, fingerprint impressions, you name it. What we're able to do now with these cases, how we're able to obtain forensic data that can be used to implicate an offender, is absolutely incredible. And I say it all the time, I can't imagine where we're going to be in 5 or 10 years. And the good news is it's getting harder and harder to commit a crime without being apprehended. And that's a good thing for everybody. The chief also emphasized that in addition to using the latest technology, they'll also continue collaborating with outside agencies. And that's also critically important at this juncture in the investigation. Yes, you want to keep working the case, but you want to also ensure that outside parties are questioning your work and criticizing what you're doing in a constructive way to make sure that nothing's being missed. The chief ended his statement by saying, quote, we owe it to the victims and their families to find the person responsible for this heinous crime and finally close the book on this terrible chapter of their lives. Unfortunately, that's the most recent update we have on this case. The identity of the gunman responsible for the murders of Rhoda, Jennifer, Carrie, Connie, and Sarah remains unknown, and their families continue to hope that one day the person who took so much from them will answer for their crimes. All right, let's dive into the perspective, and I want to reiterate some of the things I've already said tonight because I talked a lot in this case about where I stand. First off, I feel like the crime is financial in nature. I don't feel this was a premeditated act. I think the suspect's behavior confirms that by him looking around for cameras. That means he had never been in the store to case the joint. And it sounds like even his actions inside the store weren't very methodical. He was just kind of going with the flow. Whatever happened, happened, and he was trying to get as much money as possible, which is why before tying them up, he had the women empty their purses. Why he needed the money, we may never know. But I will tell you, in my experience as a narcotics detective for many years, we saw an influx or an increase in larcenies and robberies in the early morning hours. Why was that? A lot of drug users in the morning need their fix and they're desperate for stuff. So 4, 5, 6 in the morning, they're out there breaking into cars, stealing car radios, taking change out of the cup holders, or robbing someone on the street because they want to go see their drug dealer. Could that be the situation here? Of course it could be, or it could be something else. But it seems to me like this person was in desperate need of cash and went to the first store that they thought was susceptible to a robbery. Why they picked Lane Bryant? The only thing I can think of is that when they looked into the store, they only saw two people and they figured, hey, if I'm going to do it, it's easier to control just these two people. There's no customers. This should be easy. And then it turned into something else when other people showed up behind him. But not only did this guy not wear a mask, but he was also in the store for a relatively long time. When you think about robberies, usually they're smash and grabs. And yet if investigators are right, he was in the store for approximately 40 minutes. That opens him up to a whole can of worms, not only additional customers coming in, but the opportunity for law enforcement to arrive and figure out what's going on before he has a chance to flee the area. So a lot of risks there for someone who we're to believe may have planned this whole thing out and knew what they were doing. It seems like a hard pill to swallow. I also want to address the vehicles again really quick, because these vehicles pulled in around 10:39 a.m. and 10:40 a.m. And I know that law enforcement is out there really trying to figure out who these cars belong to, and up to this point, they haven't. And just a side note here about these cars, because I'm not too convinced that they're actually involved with the case, and I'll tell you why. I'm pushing back a little here, not to question law enforcement, but just to present a different idea, and I'm sure this has already been thought about. These vehicles were caught on camera coming in at 10:39 and 10:40 a.m., and they stayed there about 6 minutes, and then they left around the same time as the offender. All true. However, law enforcement has stated that the offender got to the Lane Bryant around 10:08 a.m. So how did he get there? If these were the cars that were involved, when those two vehicles pulled in, the offender was already inside the business. So that would be my counter to the notion that these vehicles are involved. I understand you want to identify them. Maybe there are co-conspirators that showed up later. Not something I normally see. So why I'm bringing this up is I wouldn't hang my hat on these vehicles being involved and have that be at the crux of the case, because they may be red herrings and have nothing to do with what we're trying to figure out. As far as why he shot these six women, I'm not a profiler, but looking at what we have based on witness testimony, it appears to me that he did not like women. He especially did not like women who didn't comply with his commands. And there may be something there from his past where, when he didn't have control over the women in his life, he became violent and he became emotional and erratic. And that was displayed to that witness in the short period of time. So going into the situation with a gun, having control of these women might have been something that gave him a level of gratification. So when Rhoda decided to combat his commands and he found out about it, he took that personally. Couple that with the fact that he was realizing all of these women had now seen his face. And we know based on witness testimony that in this heightened situation, he was unable to regulate his emotions. So in that moment, he made an impulsive decision and shot all of the women. And I don't think that was pre-planned. Maybe it was. But either way, going in there with the gun, there was some level of premeditation. Again, that's a question that we will only get answered if we find the person responsible. Which leads me to where we are right now. How do we find the person responsible? Few things. As the chief said, latest science and technology. It appears we have DNA. It appears we have fingerprints. Although there hasn't been anything that's popped yet, that could be because this person hasn't been apprehended before in a situation where they had to provide their fingerprints or DNA. That doesn't mean that if they or a relative is arrested down the road, or even decides to enter their data or their DNA into a database that's accessible to law enforcement, that we won't eventually get an arrest. But waiting for that, it could take years. It may never happen. So we don't want to rely on just that. As I said before, we have a voice. We have a potential vehicle being an SUV or a sedan. And then we have a face. Not only do we have his face, but we have distinguishable marks. And I'm referring to the cornrows and the braid going down the side of his right cheek with the green beads. So there are people out there who know who this guy is. And I'm talking about friends. I'm talking about family. I'm talking about associates. People know who this guy is. Even if you just knew someone who had green beads from that area, but then you heard the voice, you would quickly be able to say, yeah, that's so-and-so. And yet nobody has. Why? I have no idea. I have no idea why someone wouldn't come forward. I can see a very close relative being apprehensive about snitching on someone they love and care about. But that person took 5 lives and changed the life of a 6th individual. That's the immediate people. That's not including all their family members and friends who are also affected by this tragedy. I was watching a few videos from some of the victims' family members, and they say it right out. They carry this every single day, even all these years later. And I know that the VDOC Society also looked at this case, and they wouldn't go into much detail, but they also stated publicly that this case is very solvable. So I think they're on the same page as I am. Science, technology, but more importantly, the people from that community. People already know who this guy is, and there are probably other people who haven't connected the dots. And that's why I'm covering this case, not only for the people who already have the information we need, but also the people who may have the information but just haven't connected the dots. So, just to recap, for anybody out there who's from that community and may know something that can help break open this case, on the morning of February 2nd, 2008, 5 women were murdered inside the Lane Bryant store in Tinley Park, Illinois. The gunman entered the store at 10:08 a.m., posing as a delivery person, and by 10:46 a.m., he had executed 5 victims. Surveillance footage captured 2 vehicles outside the store, a dark-colored SUV and a smaller sedan, both leaving moments after the murders. The gunman was described as a husky, medium to dark-complected black man, approximately 6 foot to 6 foot 2 inches tall, with a receding hairline and braided hair. He was wearing black jeans with rhinestones on the back pocket and a charcoal gray knit cap. His identity remains unknown. If you have any information in this case, please call the tip hotline at 708-444-5394 or email lanebryant.tipline@tinleypark.org. It is also important to note that there is still a $100,000 reward that is not dependent on a conviction. So if you bring a name forward that leads to an arrest and it seems viable, you could make a lot of money here. So if you're not going to just do it because it's the right thing to do, think about the financial incentive. It could really help a lot of people out. And finally, I want to send all my thoughts to the families. It's unfortunate that 16 years later, we're still sitting here without answers. But the good news is there's a lot of information to work with, and cases have been solved with a lot less evidence. So keep up the hope, keep up the optimism, and keep pushing forward. And we're going to hope that this little episode and hopefully others who will now cover this case will get the exposure out there to the people who can make a difference. And the next time we talk about this case, it will be because we have someone in custody. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.